something.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Really?
Members, we'll call the meeting to order of Transportation Policy and Finance for January 31st, 2011. And approval of minutes. Ron Szymanski, Representative Szymanski. So moved. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? If not, all in favor, vote by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. I guess I got to hit that again. I'm going to screw this up, I'm sure.
You're doing fine so far, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, first on our agenda is a presentation by Minnesota Department of Public Safety, Mary Ellison and Colonel Mark Donaski. So if you are here.
Colonel Mark Donaski is here. We're going to not yet.
If you want to come to the podium and get us going here.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jared Joydall. I'm the Legislative Director for the Department of Public Safety. We anticipate Acting Commissioner Ellison momentarily, but I'll go ahead and get us started. This is a base budget overview for 12-13 for the Department of Public Safety. What is the DPS mission? To protect citizens and communities, prevent, prepare, respond, recover, educate, and enforce. Focus on saving lives, providing efficient and effective services. Maintain public trust and developing strong partnerships. Our agency is split in its jurisdiction between the Public Safety Committee and the divisions of the agency that are funded by this committee, which has also policy jurisdiction. The divisions of DPS that are in the jurisdiction of this committee are the Minnesota State Patrol, Driver and Vehicle Services, the Office of Traffic Safety, Administrative and Related Services, and the Office of Pipeline Safety, which is a branch of the State Fire Marshal. Our 2012-13 biennial budget, this is Transportation Division, so the divisions within the purview of this committee, and these are direct appropriations by fund. Trunk Highway accounts for $171,736,000, or 56% of the budget. The general fund is $15,908,000, or 5%. Miscellaneous special revenue is $98,176,000, or 32%. And highway user tax distribution is $20,812,000, or 7%. The biennial expenses by category. Total compensation amounts to $222,510,000, or 73% of the biennial budget. Operating or other, which encompasses rents and equipment, anything other than compensation, which we use to run the agency, amounts to 25%, and that's $76,088,000. Transfer payments are 1%, and that's $4,236,000. And payments to individuals amounts to 1% as well, $3,798,000, for a total budget for the divisions of DPS that are within the purview of this committee of $306,632,000.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh. Sorry, Representative Szymanski.
May I ask a question at this point, or would we like to wait till the end of the testimony?
No, let's ask him as we go.
All right. Mr. Jordahl, just out of curiosity, the payment to individuals, can you explain that just briefly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Szymanski, that is healthcare reimbursement for officers killed in the line of duty and their dependents, and it's also reimbursement for soft body armor for law enforcement.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Jordahl. I appreciate that explanation. I appreciate our officers' dedication to duty.
Mr. Jordahl, on the previous slide, the question I have is the miscellaneous dollars. What are the miscellaneous SR dollars for $98 million?
That is... Sorry.
That's,
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Frank Ahrens, Director of Office of Fiscal Administrative Services. The special revenue dollars that you're looking at in the pie chart, majority of those dollars are money that's appropriated to the Driver and Vehicle Services Division. Approximately 95 million of that is in that office. There's about 2,708,000 that's appropriated to the Office of Pipeline Safety, and basically that's where the special revenue dollars are allocated in public safety.
Okay, thank you. And you are Mary?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I apologize for being late. My name is Mary Ellison. I'm acting commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, and I was actually meeting with Mona Doman, who I think you know was appointed as a commissioner, and I just lost track of time and so had to rush over here. She sends her greetings. She was not able to be with us today, but she'll be with us beginning March 1st, and you will all enjoy getting to meet her. So
okay, well, welcome to the committee. I was lucky to get here myself. It took me 5 hours to get down here from Otter Tail, which is normally a three-hour drive in the snow and accidents and stuff. So anyway.
Thank you.
Proceed, please.
Our 2012-2013 biannual expenses by category are payments to individuals. That includes a bulletproof vest program that we reimburse local officers for a portion of the bulletproof vests that they wear. It also includes health care expense reimbursement to cities for health care that they provide to disabled firefighters and police officers injured in the line of duty. We transfer 1% of the funds that we receive to other funds within state government. That's 1%. Our operating expenses, which is everything other than compensation, total $76,088,000 per year. That's 25% of our budget. Our total compensation is $222,510,000, or 73% of our budget, for a total 12-13 biannual budget of $306,632,000. First of all, within the transportation-related functions of our department include administration and related services. That includes the Office of Communications, the Commissioner's Office, Human Resources, Fiscal and Administrative Services, and the Office of Technology and Support Services. Next is the Minnesota State Patrol. Their mission is to protect and serve all people in the state through assistance, education, and enforcement, provide support to allied agencies, and provide for the safe, efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota's roadways. The Minnesota State Patrol has an annual operating budget of $83,119,000 and a staff of 875 full-time sworn and non-sworn personnel. For the 12-13 biennium, $158,378,000 is from the Trunk Highway Fund. $1,573,000 is from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. $6,290,000 from the general fund and $19,000 approximately of federal funds. Services that the patrol offers include aviation, capital security, executive protection, the canine program, crash reconstruction, commercial vehicle enforcement, drug recognition expert, the vehicle crimes unit, DWI enforcement, fleet management, investigative services, public information, training academy, radio communications, special response team, and federal programs. And I'm going to ask Colonel Danaski to come forward and answer any questions that any of you may have over those, about those activities or those programs.
Members, any questions? Looks like you're off the hook.
Mr. Chair, that's wonderful. Thank you.
Next is the Office of Traffic Safety, and their mission, or their vision, is to reduce fatalities and serious injuries down to zero on Minnesota's roads. Their mission is to lead efforts to prevent traffic deaths and serious injuries by changing behavior on the roadways in Minnesota. Their programs include traffic outreach, traffic safety outreach, impaired driving prevention, seatbelt use, child passenger safety, traffic records and data systems, Safe Road Coalition, motorcycle safety, teen driver programs, underage alcohol prevention, distracted driving prevention, traffic safety research and analysis, crash outcome and data evaluation, and a fatality analysis record system. The Office of Traffic Safety receives an annual appropriation from the Trunk Highway Fund of $435,000, and that is a match for the federal funding that we received through the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration that amounts to approximately $37 million per year. I'm going to ask Cherie Marty to come forward. As I just described briefly, the Towards Zero Deaths program, and that's a partnership between the Minnesota Departments of Public Safety, Transportation, and Health, and many traffic safety advocates and organizations. The mission of Towards Zero Death is to create a culture in which traffic fatalities and serious injuries are no longer acceptable through the application of education, engineering, enforcement, and emergency medical and trauma services. This is Cherie Marty. She's director of the Office of Traffic Safety, so if any of you have any questions for her, she's here to answer them.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you. For the record, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it's Cherie Marty, M-A-R-T-I.
Thank you.
Just a comment, traffic fatalities is the number one killer of Minnesotans ages 1 to 34. Earlier this decade, we averaged around 600 fatalities each year and approximately 2,400 serious life-changing injuries. These are simple numbers, but yet every number does tell a story of someone that has been tragically killed or seriously injured and have left behind members of their family and their friends. So these tragedies are never anticipated, but they are most certainly largely avoided. As Deputy Commissioner Ellison has said, the Office of Traffic Safety, our role is truly to work with drivers and motorists to change their driving behavior. And this is, in fact, the greatest contributor to traffic crashes. You can look at factors of the road, the vehicle, and the driver. And in all of our crashes, about 90% of the reason why that crash occurred was some driver choice. So we work to influence those choices through using an interdisciplinary approach. Deputy Commissioner Ellison had mentioned the Towards Zero Death program. That program really seeks to bring together engineering, enforcement, education, and emergency trauma services statewide. So we are coordinating this program in partnership with the Department of Transportation, Public Safety, and Health. So just to run through some high points with our traffic statistics, in 2010, to date, we have 414 fatalities. Those are preliminary numbers. Last year, in 2009, we ended the year with 421. So we're continuing to move in the right direction. And in fact, since 2004, we have been consistently driving those fatality numbers down. In addition, one of our successes is a reduction in serious injuries, which is significant. We've had a 7% decrease since last year, so we've now decreased our fatalities to just over 1,100 each year. Those are those were serious injuries. We are seeing a continuous decline in those as well. Our daytime seatbelt compliance rate is now at an all-time high at 92%. And again, we're continuing to see an increase in people buckling up and keeping themselves safe. Overall, the vehicle miles traveled has consistently increased, or in the last 4 years stayed about the same. So although the deaths are going down, we are seeing the vehicle miles traveled has, as I've said, increased or remained about the same. And then finally, motorcycle fatalities, we've had tremendous success there. We're at an all-time high with our ridership in Minnesota, but we are seeing tremendous gains in reduced fatalities and serious injuries. So that is one of our hallmarks, and we'd like to see that trend continue. So I've highlighted just a few broad successes, but I do want to say that we feel strongly that one of the factors that is giving us these gains in Minnesota is the fact that we have had traffic safety legislation that's been very effective in helping Minnesota be number two in the country in our fatality rate, only behind Massachusetts. And I also learned on Friday that Minnesota is the only state in the region that has actually decreased our fatalities in 2010. all of the other states in our region have seen increases. So we're continuing that trend, and we think we've have been successful in working with our partners in enforcement, education, emergency trauma care, and engineering. And with that, I'll take your questions.
Okay, thank you. I believe Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Marty, for your excellent work over the years. I'm wondering if you could comment on the teen death rate on the roads. I know we've had some issues with that here in the state, deaths and injuries. We've had the graduated driver legislation passed a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. What are the trends in that subcategory of teen drivers?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, we are seeing a decrease in our teen fatalities. In particular, when you look at the graduated driver's licensing bill that was passed and it went into effect in 2008, July 1, we are looking at our crash data and taking 1 year of data prior to the graduated driver's licensing bill going into effect, so that would be year 2007, and 1 year after that bill went into effect. And we're looking at comparative data. So when you're looking at that, we're looking particularly at 16 and 17-year-old drivers, which is what the graduated driver's licensing bill addresses. We're seeing a decrease in 26% in crash involvement of 16 and 17-year-olds overall, which is a good trend. We're also seeing a decrease in 25% of fatalities and serious injuries of 16-year-old drivers, and an 8.8% decrease in fatalities and serious injuries for 17-year-old drivers. Overall, our fatalities for both 16 and 17 vehicle occupants, not just focusing on drivers, we're seeing a 45% decrease. So in 2007, we had 20 teen fatalities in that 16 to 17-year-old age range. In 2009, that was decreased to 11. So I do want to comment that it's important that we give these legislation like GDL some time, but that is a snapshot of looking at pre- and post-crash data since that law was enacted.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And then one other related question. You mentioned distracted driving, and I guess I've heard that's one of the leading causes of death and injury, and I wanted to see if you could confirm that. And do you have any data on any of the impact of the no texting while driving law that we passed a couple of years ago in terms of number of citations, any cause effect in that law having some net impacts on safety? So two questions, Mr. Chair, and then I'm done, I promise.
Promise?
Yeah.
Okay, Ms. Marty?
Unless something really controversial.
Well, you promise. You promise. Ms. Marty?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, the distracted driving continues to be a leading factor, particularly in multi-vehicle crashes in Minnesota. So approximately 25% of all crashes that the law enforcement officer has identified inattentive driving, distracted driving, as a contributing factor. So it is a factor in about 70 fatalities each year. In terms of the law's impact, we believe that the no texting, no emailing, no accessing the web while driving or in traffic, that particular legislation is an important tool for parents to use to communicate to their teens that this is behavior that's particularly dangerous, that it's something that is outside of the law. Because we know that our young drivers will take liberties to stay connected to their friends and their peers at all hours of the day, including while they're driving. So I think that's truly the strength of this law. In terms of the number of citations that are issued, I don't have that data with me right now, but I do know that it is challenging for law enforcement to enforce this particular practice. It's something that what we're sometimes seeing is that you've got drivers that are lowering their phones so that because it's illegal, they're lowering it, and it's more challenging for officers to actually view this behavior.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Marty, roundabouts have been popping up all around the state. And I know the rationale for the roundabouts is to reduce the number of T-bone collisions at crossing intersections. Do you have any data reflecting, you know, the incidence rate in roundabouts, you know, compared to their previous history of that same intersection related to fatal accidents? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and Representative Szymanski, because that is an engineering intervention for crash involvement, I know that our partners, our engineering partners in MnDOT, could comment more specifically, but I do know that we are hosting safety workshops in all of the 87 counties across the state, and roundabouts is one of the infrastructure strategies that are clearly used to enhance road safety. They are clearly a proven measure for reducing serious and fatal crashes. What I've learned in these workshops is that you may have an increase in minor crashes, cars, you know, bumping each other's bumper, but you see a dramatic decrease in fatalities and serious injuries with the use of roundabouts. So for specifics, I'd have to turn to our engineering partners on the stats.
Thank you. Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Marty, wondering if you could just give us a quick version of the graduated bill for 16 and 17-year-olds, what rules they have to follow under that, and what are the penalties or what happens if they break the rules?
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the graduated driver's licensing bill is really intended to protect young drivers in their learning phase as they are embarking to drive on their own, so reducing two risk factors, evening driving and the number of passengers in their vehicle. So we do this and we gradually increase their level of risk as it to commensurate with their level of experience. So that's the intent behind the bill. And research has shown that the number of passengers and nighttime driving are two very strong risk factors contributing to teen crashes. So the Minnesota graduated driver's licensing law is for the first 6 months of that provisional license, that license where they've gotten out of their permit phase. They're now learning for 12 months. For the 6 months of the 12, there's no driving between midnight and 5 a.m. unless accompanied by a licensed driver 25 years of age. And the exception to that is if they have a school event or employment. For the first 6 months, no more than one passenger can ride with that teen driver under the age of 20. And again, immediate members of the family, they are accepted from this. Or this teen driver, if they have more than one passenger, they need to be accompanied by a parent or guardian. So for the second 6 months of that 12-month period, that nighttime driving restriction is lifted. So there is no nighttime restrictions for the second 6 months, but there is a passenger limitation of three or more that are under the age of 20. Okay. Is there a second part of that?
I guess the second part of that was what are the penalties?
Oh.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
What are the penalties enforced? And just real briefly.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe this is essentially if an individual is violating these restrictions, that there would be an additional time added to before they could actually receive their full license. And what that time period is, I apologize, I would need to get back to you on what that is. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Representative, would you like that information?
Sure.
Okay. If you could get that for us.
I will. I will do that. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Leidinger, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Real quickly, you said 90% of the accidents are due to driver choice. Is that one of the comments that you made? Can you elaborate on that just a little bit?
Mr. Chair and Representative, when you look at the factors contributing to crashes, you've got driver behavior, you have factors that relate to the vehicle, and factors that relate to the road conditions. In the crashes, you've got driver behavior is a contributing factor for 90% of the reason why that crash occurred. Now, it also, you will add in road conditions and you'll add in characteristics of the vehicle, which goes above and beyond 100%. This is what I've seen from the research. So in other words, that behavior is the by far the greatest contributor to crashes, because it's a combination of factors whenever a crash occurs. So you have behavior is predominantly a factor in these crashes. Is that? So it's a combination, yes. So it'll actually go over 100%.
All right, let me like to do a follow-up on that then. You've obviously had success, which means that there's been behavioral modification. Mm-hmm. So my question is it the deterrence that works, or is it the education that works, or is it something else? Where's the success coming from?
Ms. Marty.
Mr. Chair and Representative, what we have learned is that we strongly believe that the education that we do, and we invest quite a bit in education to educate the public about the behaviors that are dangerous in their driving, as well as the enforcement, the consequences if they engage in these behaviors. So the research has shown over and over again that the best combination of changing driver behavior is education coupled with enforcement. That's what works, and that's what our offices support.
Thank you. Thank you.
Members, any more questions? Thank you, Ms. Marty.
Moving on to the Driver and Vehicle Services Division of our department. The mission of Driver and Vehicle Services is providing fast, which is fair, accurate, secure, and timely service through effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, and quality information and technical support for staff and business partners. Driver and Vehicle Services has an annual budget of approximately $55 million with 538 employees working in 98 locations throughout the state. They collect about $950 million in state revenue, and DVS is funded by the Special Revenue Fund and the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. And I'm going to ask Ms. McCormick, who is Director of Driver and Vehicle Services, to come forward. But just briefly, they provide title and registration services, driver examination services, driver compliance, driver's license issuance, special plate and disability parking credentials, auto dealer licensing and salvage vehicle inspection, interstate truck licensing and fuel tax collection, a public information center, and document management and records. This is Pat McCormick, Director of Driver and Vehicle Services.
Good afternoon, Ms. McCormick. Please identify yourself for the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services.
Thank you. You may proceed.
We, as Commissioner Ellison just stated, we oversee driver licensing, driver compliance, title and registration of vehicles. We also license dealers. We produce plates. We oversee plate production, as well as have a public information system. We oversee the dispersion of any driver or vehicle records. We collect crash record data. And we also work with our Office of Technology Support Services in terms of any technical projects that we may be required to implement. You have several handouts from DVS, and one handout talks specifically about the Minnesota Driver and Vehicle MNLARS system, which is called the Minnesota Licensing and Registration System. And if you look on the third page of that handout, It provides some statistics on DVS in fiscal year 10. It provides the production numbers that we produce in terms of documents and transactions that we do, as well as the collection of funds that DVS collects on behalf of various state agencies, as well as our own special revenue, which comes from the filing fees that DVS collects in terms of driver license transactions and motor vehicle transactions. So with that, I'd be glad, or I should say, as I think the commissioner said earlier, our mission is to provide what we use the acronym FAST services, which is fair, accurate, secure, and timely services. And I'd be glad to respond to any questions you might have.
Members, any questions? Representative Shemansky, it seems to be your day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't mean to lead off every block of questions here, but just noticing on the third page of your handout here, the average daily transactions is 5,000 driver's license, 5,000 vehicle title registrations, and then the annual online transactions, 375,000. Are we more efficient in one system or another, or what? Why do we have what I would think are maybe fewer online transactions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Shemansky. That's the reason that number is low is because of the fact that the current information system that DVS operates with is a system that was designed in the 1980s, and it's a mainframe system. It does not allow for electronic communication between information systems, and so we have limited use to do online transactions. When we've done that, we've had to be very careful in terms of the scope, because our system is so fragile, and we do not want to have the system crash. And so we do them specifically in terms of the online registration renewal system that we have, which is not used widely. Most Minnesotans prefer to go to their deputy registrar office. I think it's like 74% visit their deputy office to get their tabs. We use it as an alternative because we do believe that customers should have alternatives, so we offer registration through the mail, through our deputy offices, and then through the online transaction. But the online, there is an additional financial cost to that because we have to pay the bank for having the secure transmission of financial data, and so there's an additional surcharge. And it's used by about 6%, I think, of our customers. We also use online transactions for some types of driver license renewal or duplicate. But there again, it's a very limited number because it can't involve any change to the record. It just has to be a renewal of as-is data so that we're allowed to do it. And obviously, that is the reason why we have been working on this MNLARS system, so that we can ensure that we're able to offer our constituents and customers a better way to get their services more quickly. We only have to enter in the information once. We also are able to ensure the security of that information and secure transactions if we are communicating with other information systems. And so that's why you see a very small number of transactions being done that way and through our current environment.
Follow-up?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, follow-up question. When do you anticipate, deploying the MNLARS and retiring this old system? Do you have a timeline on that?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Shemansky, I appreciate you bringing that up on the last page of the handout. It does give you at least some an estimated timeline. Right now, the department is in negotiations with the selected vendor, and because we are involved in the state procurement process at this current time, we can't talk about who the vendor is other than to say that we're in negotiations with them. We hope that that will be completed by the by March or April in the spring of this year, and at that time the timeline will certainly be part of these negotiations and any contract the state would enter into for the actual design and implementation of MNLAR. So hopefully later this session we should be able to give you an update on that timeline.
Thank you. One question I would have with the online registration and the mail-in registration, the deputy registrars are losing business on that. Does the state reimburse them a small part of that fee?
Mr. Chair, the deputies receive the filing fee for the transactions that they do, but because we have to do the transactions involved in the tab renewals that we take in, those costs just cover our expenses, and so they don't get the filing fee for those transactions. It's probably around 24% of all registration renewals are done by DVS, and it's around 75 are done by the deputy registrars.
Okay, thank you. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've already had the deputy registrar representative in my office asking for an increase in the fees that they charge so they can be properly remunerated for the services they render. However, did I understand that the online is more expensive than going to the deputy registrar because of security with the vendor, or is that true?
Yes, McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that is the case. That's what I was talking about, because we have to pay the bank for the fact that all financial information will come to the bank site, which is a financially secure website. And there was concern that in the transmission of the data that somehow there could be a problem with that. And so the department was evaluated, and we needed to change the system we had. And so there's a $1.75 additional charge for those transactions.
That's more expensive than they're asking for an increase in fees. So I'm wondering why we're pursuing a more expensive way to renew other than the convenience issue. But nevertheless, will the new software system lead to some efficiencies? You would think at least that doing this online should be cheaper. And and more efficient, centralized, and so on and so forth. Will this new software bring new efficiencies, or is it an issue of as you get more people that are using the system, the actual unit cost goes down? So there are some efficiencies that would be brought if two or three times the number of people that currently use the system. Would that help?
Yes, McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the department wants to ensure that in any process that we do, we're only entering the information one time. So certainly we want to ensure that, because that ensures more accuracy with only entering the information one time. But we also see the value in offering different avenues to our customers so that they can either come in person, by the mail, or online. The point would be that we would like to have a system that would be able to be operated along with the assistance of the deputies, but that the information is entered once and not entered as it is now, partially at the deputy office in terms of title transactions, and then once again at our office or with driver's licenses, the same thing where it's entered on the application, which is processed at a DL agent or exam office, and then it's entered again at our home office. The concern is that we certainly want to analyze and make sure the data is correct, but we'd like to have that one point of entry, and so we do. That is one of the goals for the MNLARS project, and we think it will be much more efficient and hopefully save us much time in terms of getting these transactions processed quickly.
One more question, follow-up. So often, it's been my experience in the short time that I've been here, 3-4 weeks, that we employ new software, new systems that are designed to bring efficiencies, but I don't see a lot of accountability. So as part of this, will we see some, okay, this is going to bring some efficiencies, we're only going to have to add one time, but as far as, you know, the payback to the taxpayer, will we see something in this that will allow us to, as a committee, to see, we're going to save 20% of the work hours because we only enter this data one time.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we intend to keep the committee, the legislature, very involved in updates on MNLARS. We will be certainly involving our stakeholders, the deputies, the DL agents, the dealers, will all be involved to ensure, and we certainly understand that it's important that we be able to show that this system will streamline and improve our efficiency, but most of all, our accuracy and the security of the documents that we're producing on behalf of the state. Mr. Chair? May I address this too? Mr. Chair and Representative, part of what you see happening with the MNLARS system is an investment in the infrastructure. This system was originally created in the 1980s before there were laptop computers. And so we have more and more federal mandates and security mandates to secure information, to be able to transmit information between agencies, between states, with other states, between our state and the federal government. So literally what we were seeing with this old system is that we weren't able to comply with some of the mandates we have, which would cost the state of Minnesota millions and millions of dollars in lost federal funding, in addition to breaches of security. And so part of the goal is to streamline our processes, make them more efficient. Certainly the work is going to change as we advance. However, I just want to say that part of this is an investment because we haven't been able to invest in this very important information system that collects close to $1 billion a year in revenue and distributes it all throughout state government. So it certainly is going to bring more efficiencies, and certainly jobs are going to change and become more efficient, but also it's an investment that we have to make in order to keep up with all of the demands that we have in this modern world and with the increased federal requirements.
Okay, follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one last comment, I guess, and that is I'm running a large organization myself, working for the federal government for many years. I was never the recipient of a large capital investment, be it equipment or software or process, that somebody didn't say, this is the impact to your budget operationally, and these are the work hours that we will extract. So that's my I'll leave it with that, and understanding that is part of this process, mm-hmm. But then there are, when we talk about greater efficiencies, but we're also making sure that we're living up to our responsibilities with federal mandates and the like. Thank you.
Okay, members, any more questions? Ms. McCormick, thank you very much.
Thank you. Then the last division that we'll cover is the Office of Pipeline Safety, which is part of the State Fire Marshal's Office. Their mission is to protect lives, property, and the environment through the implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident and incident investigations, and education. The Office of Pipeline Safety has a budget of $3.15 million per year, and that's obtained through special revenue and federal funds. $1.35 million per year is a direct appropriation in the special revenue, which is derived from fees that we collect for the inspections that we do. The Office of Pipeline Safety provides pipeline inspections, both smaller companies and major pipeline projects, pipeline incident investigations, enforcement, and damage prevention. I have next to me Jerry Rosendahl, who is director, who is state fire marshal and also directs the Office of Pipeline Safety, to answer any questions.
Good afternoon, Mr. Rosendahl, and welcome to the committee. So please introduce yourself and educate us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Jerry Rosendahl, State Fire Marshal, which is also Director of Pipeline Safety. Many of you will probably remember the Mounds View pipeline explosion with the double fatalities back in 1986. The legislature created the Office of Pipeline Safety then the following year in 1987. We deal with 30 municipal gas systems, 12 private gas distribution systems, and over 100 pipeline facility operators in Minnesota's program. In 2010, the office conducted over 1,200 inspections of pipeline companies throughout the state. We also investigated over 140 pipeline-related events, incidents, accidents. In 2010, we wrote 68 enforcement actions that addressed 344 probable violations of pipeline safety regulations. And I would point out that the enforcement action, the penalties, are essentially the last resort. Education is our first priority in working with companies to achieve compliance. We also deal with the damage prevention side, which is the, as you should know, hopefully, the Gopher State One Call system, which is the call before you dig, at least 48 hours before you put a shovel into the ground. If you're personal at home or in your lot, or certainly the bigger companies that excavate with the bigger shovels, the One Call Center that notifies all of the utilities that are located in that particular area. They come out and put all that pretty paint all over your yard or all over the area, and that at least helps the people doing the digging to attempt to avoid hitting any natural gas or hazardous liquid lines or electric lines, cable lines, television, etc. In 2010, we enforced that Gopher State One Call Law, and in 2010, we issued 138 violations, totaling over $56,000 in proposed penalties. And again, those were after education, typically repeat offenders or very serious matters. The statistics collected demonstrate that enforcement and education combined, I heard that question asked earlier, have resulted over the last to gas and electric facilities since 1996 have resulted in a reduction of 70% of damages. That all that information is on the handout. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Members, any questions? Frank, did I scare you off?
No, I think Mr. Representative Szymanski's got my question.
No questions. Oh, Representative Szymanski.
Why break a good run? On the back page of your handout is the map of Minnesota with the complaints and pipeline incidents investigated. We have about three or four counties that stand out there. Any rationale, or are they more diligent, or are we closer to the surface on those? Or?
Mr. Chair and members, it typically relates to the number of miles of pipeline or the culmination point, terminal. A lot of the certainly up in St. Louis County coming in towards Superior, a lot of our interstate lines come into Minnesota from Canada, Alaska, and then go on into Superior, so there's some issues there. The metro area is just a lot more excavating, you know, typically going on. The 13 up in, I think that's Clearbrook, where there's an Enbridge pipeline terminal, and again, that relates to the new construction, adding pipelines, work around the terminal.
Follow up?
Mr. Chairman, if I may follow up, you had referred to the incident, I believe you said 1986, when there was an accident. Do we know the lifespan, the integrity of the pipeline, or do they ever reach a point where they're not reliable and should be replaced?
Mr. Rosendahl?
Mr. Chair and members, there really isn't a typical or end life or whatever. The lifespan of a particular pipe is based on an ongoing annual or every 5 years or whatever the inspection program set up by the company, monitored by us, to where they send these electronic devices through the pipes and analyze a crack or a bump, a weld going bad. It's amazing the technology that how they can monitor the status of the pipeline. The pipeline integrity is a very small piece of what we're seeing in terms of accidents and failures and events. Third-party damage is the cause. We're driving things into the ground. We're digging, even though the marks are there. We're not hand digging when we get close to the pipe. Maybe the marks aren't there. Maybe they've been scratched out during construction. A number of things like that. But third-party damage is the reason for the failure of the pipeline. The pipes themselves are monitored extremely tightly by the company because they're after certainly keeping the product moving, and by our office enforcing the law.
Members, excuse me, any other questions? If not, Mr. Rosendahl, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That concludes our presentation, unless there are any other questions.
Members, any more questions for the commissioner, anybody else? Thank you very much. Very
thank
informative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. A reminder, our next meeting will be February 2nd, and that's in the basement, so we keep flip-flopping these rooms. So with that, we're adjourned.